Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series.
G'day there, I'm Osman Faruqi. I'm a journalist and a writer and currently working as the head of audio at Schwartz Media based right here in Melbourne. And before I get into the introductions for today's event, I would like to respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that I'm speaking on today, the Kulin Nation, in particular the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people. I pay respect to the elders past and present and the elders of all communities across Victoria. Things are obviously a little bit different for us this time around, the Melbourne Writers Festival. We have just entered into another lockdown in Melbourne. I'm here in my office, but you know, regardless, the Melbourne Writers Festival digital program is going to be bringing you some of the world's best literary voices right into your lounge room, your office, your bed, wherever you're watching us. Come to you from. We've got Pulitzer Prize winning authors, we've got debut authors, we've got the most talked about novelists of the year. And I'm really excited to be talking to one of those today, Rahman Alam, the author of Leave the World Behind. It's easily one of the year's most talked about books. It's a dystopic, tense, kind of frightening, but also very funny story of a family going on a vacation and things go very wrong when some unexpected visitors arrive and the world seemingly starts to get very grim. Rahman, thank you so much for joining us on this chat. I'm so looking forward to speaking to you.
No, it's such a great pleasure. It's such a great pleasure. And as you say, with respect to the Writers Festival and with respect to, you know, I think there's so little silver lining we can point to about the current moment, but the fact that audiences can participate in this sort of thing despite all of the conditions of the current moment is kind of exhilarating to me. So it's really a thrill, really a thrill.
Yeah, fantastic. You're right. I feel like there's probably a lot of people that might otherwise not be able to see or benefit from a conversation with you like this, but now we'll be able to. Your book, your writing in general, focuses on so many themes and topics that I myself am really interested in, themes around class, race, privilege, the way that the world operates and the direction that we're heading in. So there's going to be a lot for us to get into, and I'm really excited. And I mean, I want to start with what is probably at this stage the obvious or even cliche framing around art and work this far into the pandemic. It feels so tired to say that a work is prescient or prophetic, but despite me acknowledging that, I still need to ask you about it just because, you know, we've got the central metaphor of Leave the World Behind being a group of people trapped inside a space as the world seemingly collapses around them. Can you tell me a bit about why you wanted to explore that as a concept? Were you drawing on something in our collective past, an experience you might have had, or were you trying to imagine a potential future?
When I designed that operating metaphor of people trapped inside of a home, it seemed really outlandish. It seemed truly metaphorical. It seemed that those circumstances would never come to pass in reality. So I couldn't have predicted a cultural moment in which those of us fortunate enough to have a home to call our own began to feel that we were trapped inside of its walls. Really, I think in the writing of the book, it was a metaphor for our relationship to the planet and our relationship to that planet's climate. We can't leave this place. Jeff Bezos can leave, you know, Richard Branson mm-hmm. can leave, but you and I can't leave. And that notion of a space that was meant to be a haven and had become kind of a trap felt like a really interesting way of writing about what was happening with the climate, what's happening right now with the climate. But I think that, as you say, there's a lot of talk about prescience in literature or in art. That conversation or that kind of talk, I think, reveals one of the functions of art, which is to help us make sense of the current moment. If you think about, you know, what happened in this country's politics just a few years ago, everybody was talking about Big Brother or, you know, 1984. Everyone was talking about Orwell. That's a book that was decades old, but suddenly felt newly relevant and prescient again. And so it just is a reminder that that's sort of the function of art itself, and that in a moment of difficulty, we turn to art because we don't know where else to turn. I'm not a journalist. I would never claim that mantle, but I do work on a podcast where I interview people. And last year I interviewed a woman who's a curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And we talked about the relationship to art during that moment when all of the museums were closed. And she said this thing to me that I found so striking, which is that museum attendance in New York City skyrocketed after 9/11. That in a moment of real difficulty, just a real moment of searching culturally, well, we don't know where else to turn and we're constantly looking at the headlines, art contains something, solace, transcendence, but also I think information, I think a way of helping us understand what's happening to us. And I think that there have been a lot of books in the past handful of years that I love to position my book as akin to. I don't know whether those writers would want me to claim that, but there are so many writers who are thinking about climate, who are thinking about the individual,
and there are writers you're thinking about.
So the two books that I'm thinking of when I say this both came out in 2020 when my book was published in this country. One is Jenny Offal's novel Weather, which is an extraordinary book about the individual conscience trying to understand the planet. And another book is Lydia Millett's novel, A Children's Bible, also an extraordinary book, really funny, really electric, that's sort of comically, it's not dissimilar from my book, really. It's about a group of several families who are on holiday at the seashore, and there's a kind of climactic weather event, and the children kind of survive. And so I think that these are things that are in the ether for all of us. And, you know, artists always have a responsibility to sort of distill that. And in a pressing moment, the works that seem to best answer the big questions of the day rise to the fore.
That's a really, really fantastic answer. And I was actually thinking as you're saying that, that drawing these comparisons to kind of the times that we live in, these quote unquote unprecedented times, almost does a disservice to it. Because I do think that you obviously weren't imagining a pandemic when you're writing. You talk about climate change quite openly there. And I feel like if the pandemic hadn't occurred, if the, you know, lockdowns and social isolation wasn't happening, I think we would all still be describing it as extremely, you know, relevant to our times right now. There would be so many things for us to point to. I think, you know, I cast my mind back to the start of 2020 when so much of Australia was blanketed in smoke because of bushfires. And it's a similar eerie sort of sense. You're stuck at home, you're hearing and seeing things, you're feeling the heat. I imagine that would be a touch point that a lot of Australians would have thought about when they were thinking about leaving the world behind.
A book always becomes what the reader wants it to be. The book ceases to belong to the writer upon publication and becomes whatever the reader requires it to be. And that's sort of the marvelous thing about books. And, you know, like another book I mentioned, 1984, but another book that I heard a lot of people talk about in this country during the first period of quarantine was The Magic Mountain. Thomas Mann's book, which is one of my favorite novels of all time. And Mann, I don't know how he would describe that book. I feel that he would describe the book as sort of like an allegory of Europe on the precipice of the First World War. It's remarkable to think that that book, eight decades on, would feel resonant in this wholly new way. But that's how art works. It's so elastic.
Yeah, absolutely. You've talked pretty openly before about one of the experiences that shaped the kind of central conceit of this book, this trip you had in an Airbnb back in 2017. You're currently, I think, in an Airbnb somewhere outside of New York City.
Yes,
can you tell me about where you are?
I'm not quite.
What experience you had?
Yes. So, yes, in 2017, I was on holiday in a small town on Long Island, close to the coast. And I am right now on an island off the coast of Long Island called Fire Island, which is a very narrow barrier island between the Sound and the Atlantic. It's extremely narrow, extremely long. There's a sort of invasive population of deer here. It's very quiet. It's very dark. I've spent a lot of time here over the past 16 years or so. It's a place I love. I love to come with my family. But there is, you know, I'm a sort of cowardly, soft city living guy. And so there's a kind of, whenever I'm out in the natural world, I feel a kind of menace. It's so dark, you can see all the stars. I can hear the ocean all night long through the window. And it's just like, it's incredible, it's transcendent, but it's also like, oh, I'm afraid. And so there's something about that atmosphere of our summer vacations that was really interesting to me that I wanted so badly to write about. But I knew, or I had a sense that I didn't want to write a straightforward novel of middle-class family on vacation. There are many such novels, and I love many of them, but it just wasn't what I wanted to do. And when I realized how to wed my own unease with the natural world, with the sort of the anxieties that I think are so, that they're the thrum of modern life, the book sort of coalesced for me then.
Yeah. And can you talk me through a little bit about what happened then? So you had these big picture sort of ideas, things that you wanted to grapple with, themes that you wanted to explore. You have that experience and you're like, oh, okay, I think this might help me pull it all together. Did you start writing it then and there? How long did it take for you to put it all together?
Yeah. I knew that I wanted the shape of this book to be different than my two previous works, which are sort of, as a reader, I love a book that kind of ruminates and meanders, but I understand that there's a different kind of pleasure in a book that is really taut and really propulsive, and that most of what we see that achieve sort of widespread commercial acclaim are books that really deliver on this feeling of entertainment, that you're sort of stuck inside of them and they propel you through them. And I was really intrigued by that. I think that sometimes I think literary writers can demean what I'm talking about, which is sort of the trope, the allure of genre fiction. But I think that it takes a very specific kind of genius to be able to write a book that entertains a lot of people. If it were easy to do, more people would do it, you know? And so I knew that that was sort of the energy I wanted in the book. And so I read a few works that are probably better classified as horror, just to understand some of the conventions of how those books are shaped. And I tried to wed that shape to the objective of writing about climate. And of course, horror is often metaphorizing something, right? So a book about vampires could also really be talking about McCarthyism, right? Like that's what writers do. They use their imaginations. And I felt really, there was a lot of appeal to me in trying to do that. And so I had a sense of how to marry these two things. And I wrote a draft of this book extremely quickly. I think I wrote a draft of the book in 3 weeks, which is really an insane turnaround. But I think it's really important to point out that like the relationship between a draft and a finished book is like the relationship between a seed and a plant. They're completely different animals. But I do think that writing it very quickly, there's a trace of the propulsion with which I wrote it in the finished product. I knew I wanted it to feel like there's almost a ticking clock in the corner of the page. You're simultaneously conscious of time passing and also confused about how much time has passed. And even now, I'm not really sure how much time passes in the novel. I haven't read the book since I turned it in, but I think it's 3 days, but it might be 2 days. But there's something kind of great to me about the fact that you lose track of it at a certain point, because you, as the reader, hopefully, are sort of participating in the book in exactly the same way that the fictional people are.
Yeah, I think propulsive is the perfect way to describe it. I've read it 3 times now, and the first 2 times I read it in one sitting, and the third time I only was disrupted because I was disembarking from a flight. You're right that there is something so what we consider to be, you know, highbrow literature, the tropes and associations with that, is so rarely something that is like a tight, taut book with a kind of horror-esque framing and momentum through it. And I loved the way you're talking about horror. Obviously, you know, you mentioned vampires, George Romero's zombie films are using that as the metaphor to talk about race and police. I've seen your work compared a lot to Get Out as well, in terms of, you know, a similar kind of structure and layout grappling with similar themes. It's not even my favorite thing. I think what makes the book so successful and so important is, so far we've just talked about this layer of climate change and the symbolism and the themes around that, but there is an entire, you know, there is multiple more frames around this book to do with class and race. And I think the thing that I loved from the second that I read, you know, the first couple of pages, was not knowing an enormous amount about the detail of the book before I read it for the first time, and seeing the blurb talk about how it was an analysis of race and class, and knowing a bit about your work and your background, thinking, well, oh, okay, we're going to get some protagonists that are people of color that go into some remote, you know, out of the city town, brush up against white people, and here's where all the tension potentially comes from. And realizing that, no, what we're doing is we're exploring this, but the characters are not some sort of avatar for yourself. Actually, the main characters we're following are middle-class white people. There's a lot I want to explore there, but the first question I want to just ask you is, you're writing about them with this sense of knowingness and fun. It seemed like you were having fun when you were filling out these characters. Is that right? Is that fair?
I think so. I mean, in your introduction, you described the book as funny, which makes me so happy because I think it's very funny. I think it's very comic. And I think Jordan Peele is a very interesting touchstone because his the two films that I've seen of his, Us and Get Out, are genuinely disturbing. They metaphorize sort of contemporary race and the dynamics of race in contemporary America. They do it with a genuine sense of fright, but they also do it with some levity. And I think that the levity sort of makes the fright more effective, and the fright makes the levity more effective. They work in concert, sort of like salt and caramel or something. And I think you're right. I think that I was having a lot of fun writing about white people. I think the book begins, as you say, if you don't really know what the book is going to do, I think when you start reading it, it feels familiar. It feels like a novel of manners about a middle-class family. And I wanted it to seduce you into believing it was going to be a book about a couple getting a divorce, or, you know, the fissures emerging in a relationship. You know, there's so much literature about people leaving one place and going to another, and that lays bare something about their relationships. And then it sort of dances away from that upon the arrival of these black people. And that's another convention of the literature of storytelling, where the unexpected presence of a black person jolts the white reality, and then you have to reconcile the two. But my book offers a kind of third interruption and becomes a book that's about something else altogether. So even though I think you're right that it's clearly a book that's interested in talking about race, it's clearly interested in talking about class, there's a way in which it also kind of abandons those subjects. It uses them to lure you into that first kind of disruption, and then it moves on to a different set of questions about contemporary reality. And I think that that feels right to me. I think we have these sort of nested considerations about how society functions right now. And then the sort of more pressing matter is, you know, humanity's existence itself, and, you know, the two kind of press against one another.
I think reading this book and your other work as well, what stands out to me is it sometimes takes, not even sometimes, I think it really does take someone who is outside of a particular cultural community and therefore not assuming the default, right? I think this is so often one of the issues I find with describing white culture is, to so many white people, white culture doesn't exist. It's just, that is the world. And then you have these other groups that are different and strange. But to people like us who grow up and live in, you know, white dominant societies, we see it as white culture. And the ways that you describe, in so many ways, the main two characters, Clay and Amanda, in terms of their professional life, the way they shop, the way they speak, the way they parent, it is so observant that I think it couldn't have come from a white person. I think it does take someone outside. I want to ask you about how you what you were drawing on when you were building up those characters? Is it just your life experiences watching white people interact, or is it something maybe a more recent milieu that you've been interacting with that you really wanted to get into?
Yes, I think, as you say, the people who are most conversant in what whiteness is are people who are not white, because it's something they've studied from a perspective of distance their entire lives. Those are the people who are experts, the people who are watching. And those are also the people who sort of shift between communities. So every sort of, like in this country, there is, you can be Black American, you can be Indian American. And so you have your sort of minority majority, you're situated in both of those communities. You can move back and forth between them in a way that white people really can't. You know, it's sort of like they're not allowed to have that. And it's impossible for them to really see it. At the same time, I think it would be silly of me not to acknowledge the ways in which I'm also just writing about myself. I'm writing about the professional urban middle class. I mean, that is something I know intimately, because that is what I inhabit. And so much of the fun I'm having, and poking fun in this book, is really directed back at the self, you know? I mean, Osman, you wouldn't want me to drive you anywhere without a GPS, because I don't know where we would end up, you know?
yeah,
and totally. That's you know, that's me. And, you know, you have to kind of be able to laugh at yourself, I suppose. And I think that that's part of the reason, if there is a sting in the book, in its depictions of the comfortable, perhaps deluded, aspirational middle class of American coastal cities, it's because I know it really well. I know it really well. That's it's me.
That's fantastic, because that was actually my next question was, you know, while so much of this does seem to be about, you know, skewering or representing a kind of white vision of white America, a version of white America, you're also talking about people who are middle-class New Yorkers associated in and around the, you know, literary scene as well, you know, who are parenting. I know that you have two young kids too, and it felt like to me that this wasn't just you saying, I'm observing something else happening. I want to explore that, but I also want to go in and interrogate my approaches to class, parenting, all that sort of stuff.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I think it's I come by it honestly, you know, and I think that that is maybe why it has, I hope, for readers, a feeling of honesty, that there's a willingness to direct the critique, you know, the venom at the self, to implicate the self. Otherwise, it would feel like a cheat. And certainly, I think that the force that carries forward this kind of sense of class aspiration, or, you know, a desire, sort of base material desire, is sort of inextricable, I think, from whiteness, from the dominant modes of being in the West. There's a scene in the book where Amanda, the white renter, first is sort of encountered this Black couple, and she's asking them what they do for a living. And Ruth, the Black woman who owns the house, mentions that she used to work at this school, the Dalton School, which is a very well-known private school in Manhattan. And Amanda's first response is, oh, I wonder if she could help me get my children into the Dalton School. I think that's so funny. And I think it's also the kind of thing that a terrible person like me and all of the people I know would be hard to resist sort of having that immediate association.
That was, again, one of my favorite, and maybe because I'm watching the reboot of Gossip Girl right now, which is set in a similar sort of environment. I just thought those two things dovetailed really neatly for me. this is a question I want to ask you. I don't want to sort of dwell on this one for too long, because I think it's been such a dominant part of literary festival conversation for the past few years around identity and who has the right to write about whatever. And you know, it's a lot of that in my own view, I think these discussions around who gets to tell certain stories comes from a relatively, you know, genuine place of wanting to correct who is published and who gets to be published and, and seen. This is obviously not that. This is not you, and your work generally doesn't, is not a reflection of your identity, aside from, as we were talking about, parenting and being a middle class, you know, person from New York.
Yeah.
When you're thinking about approaching this and creating characters like Clay and Amanda, or, you know, George Washington or Ruth, are you thinking about that conversation that's happening? Are you seeing it and you're engaging with it and you're choosing to reject it, or are you just, you know, not, you're saying that's fine, but it's not something that I'm actually wanting to reckon with right now?
There's certainly some trepidation. I'm mindful of this this cultural conversation about who has the right to tell stories that don't belong to them. I do believe fundamentally artists have the liberty to do what it is they want to do. I don't think that can be legislated by any other body. And I think that in order to take that gamble as an artist, what you have to accept is the possibility that the reader might reject it. And so in writing about, in this book, as I do writing about a Black woman in her 70s, I simply have to accept that there may be a reader who is herself a Black woman in her 70s who would say to me, you got it wrong. And perhaps I did get it wrong. I think there's something to be said for intention, and I think intention is harder to gauge. There's some nuance there in judging what's being done in good faith and what's not being done in good faith. It's very hard to figure out. And I think ultimately that judgment lies in the hands of readers. And I don't think a blanket philosophy like this is a corrective against centuries of very small instances of suppression of artistic expression by people who are not white. I don't think this is the way to solve for that. I don't know that I have an answer for the way to solve for that, but I would have to be deluded not to know that there's some risk there. At the same time, I think I can acknowledge that there's very little risk in writing up towards whiteness, because as we've talked, it is the dominant mode of being, and there's a sense that it's sort of bulletproof, and that it doesn't matter if a writer who is not white inhabits whiteness, because I don't know why. I don't know. I actually don't know why that's acceptable, but it has to do with the complicated power dynamic that, like, to aim towards whiteness is to aim up, but to aim towards someone else is to aim down, and you can't, you know, it's not always fair, or it's not always done in good faith. But there's so much art. I mean, we could sit here for an hour and name books by beautiful books by men that are about women, beautiful books that, you know, explore something that is not the territory that the author knows him or herself intimately. I'm wary of imposing rules on art, but I'm happy to impose my personal judgment on it.
That's a really generous answer. And I think everything you're saying, it makes total sense to me. I think particularly in understanding where you're aiming your focus and the differences in fact, reading your book and hearing you talk, I kind of think that perhaps only non-white people should be writing about white people. I think that would be very fun and very perceptive, and
that
would probably lead to
some
really great art.
That could solve
a
lot of problems, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I want to take a step back. I mean, we talked about climate change a bit at the start. I wanted to talk about some of the big picture stuff that kind of haunts or is in the background of this book constantly. I think you give enough clues throughout the book, even without needing to say the words climate change, that is a huge part of what is looming. That is the ever encroaching threat here. But you also, there are some feints, you know, there's talk about planes and questions about war and people being reminded of 9/11. Even for me, there was another potential layer to it. I was maybe wondering whether we're going to have a kind of M. Night Shyamalan twist where turns out nothing's going on. This is just two people from different areas. Two groups of people from different backgrounds creating tension when there doesn't need to be any. When you were thinking about writing the book in that way, even though, like I said, the climate change metaphor is there, were you hoping people thought about this in whatever way, whatever their fears are, if they're scared of terrorism, if they're scared of war, were you hoping that they just bought in at that angle? Or are you really trying to say, be worried about the future of this planet?
No, I think you're right. I think it becomes kind of a Rorschach test. It reveals your own anxieties, and there's plenty, you sort of take your pick, right? You can choose from a suite of them. That's what it is to be alive in this particular moment. It's increasingly clear to me as I think about the book and as I get a little bit of distance from it, which sounds crazy because I only wrote it 2 years ago, but I'm reminded of the fact that I wrote this book when Trump was the president. And it's not a book about Trump, although I do mention him. But there was a particular anxiety that was so ever-present during his presidency, at least in my life. And I don't think I'm alone. I think many people, many of my peers have reported feeling that way. He sort of sat on the shoulder at all times, and you felt like you couldn't get away from him. But I like the idea. I mean, actually, to answer a question you didn't really ask, I don't actually know what happens in this book. Like, I have no idea. There's no larger design. There's no sense that, like, if you studied the pieces closely, like Claire Danes in Homeland, when she puts everything up on the wall and sort of tries to find the conspiracy. I don't think you could do that with this book. I don't think it would reveal anything. So those feints that you describe, the mention of a plane crashing, the mention of a car crash even, that's actually derived from my relationship to this thing. And the fact that, like, you can't go 10 minutes without getting an alert on your phone. Oh, this has happened. The president of Haiti has been assassinated. A building has collapsed in Miami. Unprecedented flooding in Germany. Are those things related to one another, or are they not? And I think they're obviously they're related in the sense that they're taking place in this current moment. Which of those things will be remembered, and which of those things will be forgotten a year from now? Which of those things will feel that we have, that they've revealed something about reality the more that we think about them? It's impossible to answer. And I think the book kind of, I hope the book functions in a similar way where you have to choose what you're going to focus on. And I have had other readers say to me what you said, which is that perhaps nothing at all happened. And who knows? If I'm telling you, I don't even know. So that's the answer, I guess. Mm.
All right, well, I'm running with that one. That makes me feel very smart and scared, so thank you. You brought up your phone, and that was a really neat segue into the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, is the role of technology, or the absence of technology as a result of what happens in the book, in the book's plot. It seems to me like you have what I think so many of us have at the moment, which is this love-hate relationship with how connected we are, which is obviously we are reliant on it. We derive pleasure from it, the kind of, you know, endorphins that rush when we refresh our emails and we feel, you know, like we're wanted and we read those news alerts. But then, as you're saying, in a way, they're kind of the villain of this book, right? Like those news alerts that pop up that create that sense of despair and frustration and chaos. Is it fair to say that it's like a love hate thing? Or are you taking a more pointed stance and saying this is terrible? What are we doing?
No, I'm not. I don't think I am a doomsday kind of person, and I don't think that I am condemning altogether the existence of technology, which abets this meeting you and I are having right now, and proved to be the salvation for so many people with their relationships to work or their children's school over the last year. Our relationship to technology has changed a lot in 18 months' time, which I guess is a part of my thinking about it, which is that technology is extremely new. This technology didn't exist. You know, I remember a time in my children's lives when I didn't have an iPhone. I had a digital camera, which seems sort of like inconceivable now. And my son is turning 12 in a couple of weeks, right? So within his lifetime, I think that we fundamentally allowed ourselves to be rewired by these machines that we carry around, that we tell ourselves are a necessity. An iPhone is $1,000. And that's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary amount of money. It's a crazy amount of money. And it's crazy to tell ourselves that it's requisite for driving on the roads, for people use it to pay for things now. In New York City, I'm sure in Melbourne too, like you use it to sort of scan the menu at restaurants so you don't have to touch anything. Mm. It's just become so integrated into daily existence. But we haven't had the distance of time to understand what it's doing to the experience of being human. Here's a story I love, and it could be apocryphal. It's sort of like somebody I know, someone told someone I know this story. That they were in the waiting room, they were in a pediatrician's waiting room, and there was an aquarium. And a toddler went over to the aquarium and tried to move the fish by touching the glass.
Oh, wow.
Extraordinary to think about. That child's relationship with reality is dictated by his mom's iPad. Absolutely mind-blowing to me to think about. We haven't had any time to think about this. It's too new, and we don't know. We just don't know. I mean, if you look at old movies now, like I was recently thinking about The Exorcist. There's an amazing scene in The Exorcist where Reagan is in the hospital and Ellen Burstyn is smoking with all of the doctors are standing around and they're all smoking. To the contemporary eye, it looks like mind-boggling to think about the physician smoking in the hospital. Are people going to say that about phones a decade from now? The idea that you would give a toddler an iPad is, you know, immoral or something. I don't know. We don't have the answer to that question yet.
Yeah, and I think that generational gap is captured quite well in the book, and it's something that it made me really think about how, I guess, people our age, our generation, we remember a time, not only a time before iPhones being ubiquitous, but a time before the internet being ubiquitous. Like, we actually have that memory. So for us, the world, we remember what it was and we remember what it is now. We see what it is now. But for, you know, people like your children's generation, they don't have that. This is the only world that they know. So what does that look like by the time they reach our age? I don't know. And I think the book is really successful at pointing to that. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I worry about it.
In terms of kids in general, I mean, we've just talked about how this book is clearly not autobiographical, but there are elements of your own life that you're drawing from as you bring into it. I was really fascinated by the decision to focus, have significant parts of the book be seen from the perspective of the two children. You know, this might be too personal a question, but as a parent, what are the things that you're learning from or thinking about when it comes to raising kids that you wanted to explore through the writing of this book?
You know, I think that it's funny that I made that choice, because I've actually long said that it's almost impossible to render child logic on the page. I've read a lot of books that attempt to do so and often felt that they sort of come up short because I think you almost can't fix it in adult language, the way a child's mind moves. And the children I'm writing about are older, which I felt like it gave me some leeway that they were sort of like in this interstitial space between pure childhood and adulthood. But of course, I mean, having children so fundamentally rewires your experience, at least for me, of being a human being, of thinking about language, of thinking about social construct, of thinking about, you know, everything around you. It allowed me to see things really differently. At the end of last year, my mother was visiting and my husband said to our kids, we were leaving the house and we were going to go out to dinner. And my husband said to my son, oh, but first we're going to stop and get grandma. And my son, who was 8, said, get her? You mean kill her? And it was so funny to me because it was like the insane logic in his head of like, oh, we're going to get her. It just revealed like some weird like flaw in language itself. And it also revealed just something so funny about his grasp on reality that like, oh, we're going to go out to dinner, but first we're going to stop and commit a murder. It was just so hilarious to me. I love that story because it's a reminder of like having children sort of reminds me how absurd language can be, or how absurd like their sense of the world can be when they're small. And it doesn't last for very long. You lose it. Like it really is lost at a certain point. And I sort of mourn that already, looking at them getting older.
One of the takeaways I had by the time I got to the end of the book is this idea of what world are we leaving behind for young people? What are they making of it, and what do they pick up and do with it? And I'm not sure if that was deliberate, but that's just how I felt and what I was thinking about at the end. How do you feel? I mean, do you feel, aside from obviously the legacy we're in the midst of leaving behind isn't great, but do you see anything from the next generation that makes you feel optimistic about their ability to change things for the better?
I do think in a strange way, this book, as grim as I think it can be, is a sort of counterintuitively optimistic book. And if there's any optimism I have about the contemporary moment, it is in the generation of which my children are a part. Because to me, there's a sense in talking to them, and I don't just think this is reserved for like the children of urban coastal America. I think it's generational. They can accept a different relationship to so many things than their parents or grandparents, really, or the generation that's currently in power. So as a very concrete example, I think you can tell any 7-year-old child, oh, this person uses the pronoun they, them. And that kid could say to you like, oh, well, tell me why. And you could answer that question and say, well, that reflects how that person feels about themselves and their relationship to what we call gender, but is really sex. And that child will say, okay, no problem. I've seen children do that. You know, I've seen children, I've had children ask me like, if my husband is my brother, and I'll say like, no, he's my husband. And they're like, oh, okay. Like, it's not, I don't think that some of these old categories of thinking are as pressing for younger people. And I think that that is promising. I think that when we talk about climate, because I do think that is sort of the thrum underneath the whole book. When I think anyway about the leadership on climate in this planet, I think about Greta Thunberg. I don't think about Donald Trump. I don't think about Joe Biden. I don't think about really any current head of state, because they're too old. They've completely fumbled it already. And I think that there is a generation of children out there who are very clear about the fact that they will inherit the world, and they want to talk about the world that they will inherit. I think that's kind of remarkable. And so I think that I do see that with a sense of optimism, but I don't see much else with a sense of optimism, I'm afraid.
No, I think that story is really great, and those examples are great, because it's a reminder of how much our understanding of the world is socially constructed, and what better way to test that than on children who are exploring it, and you can see what is innate versus what we're kind of told to believe.
That's right.
I mean, interestingly, one of my sort of theories on this is part of the reason why I see younger people, progressive is maybe too broad a term and maybe not the accurate one, but be more open to the kinds of ideas you're talking about when it comes to things like sexuality, sex and gender, as well as I think race, is just a way in which technology actually has allowed the world to feel smaller. You look at some of the most successful TikTok posts, and they're about people celebrating the diversity of culture. So you're growing up in a world that feels like the world actually looks like. The question I have for you is, we were talking before about your fear of technology on the younger generation. I mean, how does it make you feel to think that perhaps the things that are making you feel optimistic about younger people are kind of a reflection of their engagement with technology and each other that way.
That's generational because I'm an old man. You know, that's all it is. Like, I think younger people have a kind of easier relationship with the technology that has existed their entire lives. And so when we talk, you know, when we talk about fake news, for example, or conspiracy and the ways in which the internet sort of incubates that, I think that younger people have a better grasp of the medium and better understand how to think about what they're seeing than older people. I think that society in this country would be significantly improved if, for example, you could vote at the age of 16 instead of the age of 18. Because I do think that, like, I think there are very clear reasons why you can't do that, why that change has not taken place yet. I think I'm just too old. Like, I have to ask my kids to help me get on Zoom, you know. I think that, and I accept that. I accept my own kind of the obsolescence of my own generation as things on the planet become more and more dire.
I feel like I can't end this conversation without asking you about the next stage of this book, the option, the film. When I would tell people that I was speaking to you, it's the, oh, I read that that's Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington and Netflix. That's really exciting. I'm like, look, it is exciting. You should read the book. The book's great, but yeah, we should all watch this thing. What is it? I mean, of the most obvious thing to comment on here is how GH in the book is described as looking like Denzel. And that's something that's happening. What's that process been like? Is it, I'm sure it's been thrilling.
Oh, absolutely thrilling. Absolutely thrilling. I mean, so yes, he is likened to Denzel Washington, which is just affirms the significance of Washington in the culture, that he could be a yes. placeholder for, you know, a Black respectability of a certain age. It's an extraordinary, strange turn of events that he as a performer would do this film. It's amazing. It's amazing. Sam Esmail, who is the writer and director who will adapt the book, we had such great conversations about the book. And actually, so when I sold the rights to Sam, it was last summer, it was before the book was published. And he was one of the first readers I had the chance to talk to. And it was so remarkable to have a conversation with a reader who is also an artist himself, just talking about what he liked in the book and what he thought about the book. And it was, I feel like it's in such good hands, even before I knew that Denzel Washington would be involved, before I knew that Julia Roberts would be involved. And then those pieces of information, it was just like, well, what could be better? What could be better? It's an extraordinary turn of events. And, you know, and what I said to Sam the last time I spoke to him was that I wrote my book and he gets to make his movie. And like, I'm so excited to see what he does. And yeah, I mean, I'll be watching it along with everybody else. I really cannot wait.
Yeah. Is there any sense of trepidation around the fact that, you know, it's now in another artist's hands? Obviously your work, it sounds like you have a good relationship and trust with him, but your vision or the questions that you've left open, they might go in a different direction. You know, there might be some more resolution there that wasn't in your book. How do you feel about that?
That's what art does. And it's got to be elastic and you have to be comfortable with that. And I am wholly comfortable with it. And the truth is that I have to move on from this book anyway, personally, artistically. Like, I'm trying to write a book now and I need that space away from my own work. And really that's what the disruption of publication actually is. It's not the end point, because the book hopefully won't go away. You'll still have some relationship to it, but it's the point of sort of saying goodbye and letting it sort of go and do what it's going to do. And you go back, or I go back and sit down and try and do whatever it is I want to do next.
Ruman, Thank you so much for such a generous conversation. I mean, it was genuinely really inspiring and thought-provoking hearing you talk about the book. And congratulations on the book. I can't wait to see the film, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. I love, you know, again, it's been such a difficult year, but the idea that I have any reader is sort of remarkable to me. And the chance to talk to one is really, really gratifying. So thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.